Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is the author of the new book, Ali, The Life. It's a biography of the life of one of the greatest athletes in history, written by Chicago author Jonathan Eig. What's surprising about this incredible work is that it's the first definitive biography of the famed boxer and activist Muhammad Ali. Yes, there have been plenty of books written about him, his fights, also plenty of documentaries, even an award-winning film, but they all took from parts of the story. This is the first full story of the complex, complicated, legendary figure. It's unauthorized, it's honest, brutally so at times, and it looks at the life that is almost overshadowed by the legend. It's also a book that looks at a life of contrast, a story of a man who wanted to be loved and in so many ways, loved to be despised. Eig is no stranger to biographies. He's written about Jackie Robinson, Lou Gehrig, and even the birth control pill. He's a longtime writer here in town. My pleasure to welcome Jonathan Eig to the big table. Jonathan, great to see you.
You too. Thanks.
This is unbelievable work, and a work that has consumed you for five years plus. First of all, I'm so interested in this being the only biography of Muhammad Ali, because I just feel like there have been many books written about him.
There have been many books, a lot of great books. Norman Mailer, George Plimpton, you know, writers that are, you know, my heroes. David Remnick wrote a good book, but they all took slices of the story. They all took little pieces. And
about one fight.
About one fight or right. You know, the Vietnam years. And what nobody had done is just looked, stepped back and said, wait a second, this is one of the great lives of the 20th century. We should be treating him the way we treat George Washington and Abraham Lincoln. We need a big, fat biography that looks at everything, that interviews everybody who knew him, that goes through the FBI records, that just treats him like a piece of history that he is. And you know, it was perfect timing because enough time had gone by. It's 50 years since he became champ and since he protested Vietnam. But you've also still got like three out of his four wives still alive. You've got his brother still alive. You've got half the men who he fought still alive. So it was the perfect time to do this. And I interviewed everybody.
Hundreds of interviews. Talk about when you set out to do this, was the idea to do a front to back full life look at Muhammad Ali?
That was it, because I realized that's what was missing. That you know, the way to do this, the way to beat the competition was to go big. And to do the book bigger and better, I hope, than anybody had ever done it.
Was there any temptation to make it authorized? Because it was unauthorized. This is, you wanted to be a journalist and look at this objectively. But was there temptation? Because I know the Ali family said, hey, we've got an idea. I mean, talk about trying to keep it objective and independent and the goal of doing that.
Yeah, the family and the Ali marketing company came to me when they heard I was doing this and said, would you consider making this an authorized book? We'll give you access to Ali. We'll help you sell it. We'll promote it. And we'll share the money. And I said, no, not even going to think about it.
This is while he was living, right?
While he was still alive. Yeah, this was like, you know, 2013, I think. I was just getting started. And I said, that's not even a question. I wouldn't dream of doing that because I need to be objective. I need to have my, you know, I need to be free to write what I want, and including the negative stuff. And I said to them, frankly, I think that's in your best interest too, because Ali deserves a real biography, not just some slicked up, polished brand building product.
He's got enough of that.
He's got enough of that.
When you do a project like this, and with your background doing biographies, but also being a journalist, do you put out a mission statement? Do you say, okay, not only is this going to be a definitive bio, but I'm going to try and uncover the truths of Muhammad Ali. I'm going to look at that legend and kind of poke holes in what's true and what's not. Is there more than just going front to back when it comes to a biography?
I wouldn't like put out a mission statement, but the whole point of writing a biography is to help your reader understand who he really was, to try to get as close as you can to the truth as possible. I'm obviously, there's no such thing as one truth, but I'm going into this just trying to be as open and as honest as I can, figure out who made this guy, like how did he turn out this way, and how did he change the world? And I'm not going to let anybody try to, you know, sway me or try to, like, I'm not trying to spin this in one direction or another.
Right,
I'm not
right.
Selling anything, and I'm not out to take him down, and I'm not out to pretty him up either.
What's amazing is that what you're really pushing against is the legend of Muhammad Ali. There's so many stories we know in American history where you're like, okay, that Muhammad Ali threw his medal into the river,
or it didn't happen.
Yeah, but other things right. Like that. In a way, your biography debunks that, or even, and we'll talk about it in this interview. But the contrast, I can't wait till we get to the Vietnam stuff, because we all remember the conscientious objector. We remember him being the voice of the civil rights movement, but it's not necessarily how it was played out. When you look at all of the interviews he did at that time, he's kind of all over the place.
He's a really complicated guy, and his life is a mess at times. You know, he's got these great religious principles, which he violates all the time. He takes this conscientious objector status to the war, but he at one point said, you know, just take my money and go buy bomber jets and kill all the Vietnamese you want. So he's really hard to figure out, and that's what makes it so much fun for me, and that's what makes him real. Because if you just pretty him up, if you just tell the myths over and over again, then you get George Washington chopping down the cherry tree, and you don't know anything about the real man who was behind those stories.
Well, let's get into the real man, Muhammad Ali. The book is called Ali, The Life. We'll take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll start at the beginning about his humble beginnings in Louisville, Kentucky. Jonathan Eig is the author. He's my guest tonight at the big table. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest in studio, Jonathan Eig. He's the author of the new book, Ali, The Life. It's the definitive biography of Muhammad Ali from front to back. Surprising to me, the first definitive full biography of Muhammad Ali. It's hard to believe, but you're right. When you go through all the other pieces that have been done, it's always a sliver, or it's about the rumble in the jungle, or it's about one period of his life. But you go and talk about his entire life. Let's start at the beginning. Fascinating to me that he grew up in Louisville. Right out the gate, they misspell his name on the birth certificate. You find all of this stuff in your research.
Yeah, I was able to find out, first of all, that they misspelled his name on his birth certificate. His grandfather was a convicted murderer, something Ali didn't know. He killed a man over a craps game in Louisville. Great-grandson of a slave, grandson of a convicted murderer, son of a drunk wife beater, and this is who becomes the greatest man of the 20th century, you know, the most famous man of the 20th century.
There's a great passage where you talk about his father, Muhammad Ali's father, Cassius Clay's father, Cash as well, and the lessons that he taught his sons in this case. But he taught Cassius about inequality, about how black people were treated, and he also, by living in the world that he was living, showed a lot about abuse and how to treat women. But there was a lot that came from the stuff that you were able to research about his father.
Yeah, you can see the two sides of Ali's personality at war, this sweet, loving side that's so gregarious that everybody just is charmed by, and that comes from his mother. And you see the fighter and the race warrior and the womanizer, that comes from his father. These two conflicting personalities almost, you know, battling it out punch for punch in Ali's psyche. His father was a really difficult guy, but I think if without his father, he doesn't become the man who, you know, sets out to see if he can change the world, who says that I don't have to accept things the way I find them.
What's interesting is that he's not, we have so many different musicians and talented artists and athletes that are on this program, and they talk, when I was 5 years old, I did this, and it was unbelievable. Muhammad Ali, not really in the first 12 years of his life, that gifted in one way or the other, not necessarily the best athlete, not, you know, not the best charmer, everything in between. It wasn't until he actually had a chance encounter where he was looking for a stolen bike that he stumbled upon a gym.
Yeah, that's right. He was not a great athlete, didn't really like football or basketball or baseball, but he loses his bike. His bike is stolen, and he goes looking for a police officer to report it to, and the police officer happens to be running a boxing clinic. He finds a guy in the basement of a gym who's running a boxing clinic, and the police officer says, well, you want to learn to fight? And Ali becomes intrigued. He likes the sights, the smell of the ring, but most importantly, I think he sees white kids getting punched in the face by black kids. And you're not supposed to do that in Jim Crow Louisville in the 1950s. So he's intrigued by that maybe more than anything else. And the legend of that lost bike is really central to Ali. It happens to be one of those legends that turns out to be true. He really did have his bike stolen, and that led him into the boxing ring.
When I think about that, too, the next step is to talk about what boxing was like at that time. If you were into boxing in the 1950s, you had Jack Johnson,
right?
Joe Louis, mm-hmm. and they were completely different types of boxers. You had Joe Louis, who was a black boxer who could go in the ring and beat white fighters, but society was like, as long as you do it in the ring and you're respectful outside the ring. And Jack Johnson was entirely the other way. He was very flamboyant, and Cassius Clay at the time looked at Jack Johnson more of a model than Joe Louis.
That's right. Joe Louis was told, you know, you can't even raise your hands in triumph. You can't gloat over a fallen white man, because that would be suggesting that the black man was really superior. Even though he just beat the crap out of him, you can't act like you're better than that white guy. And young Cassius Clay says, what's up with that? You know, I don't have to do that. And as soon as he starts winning, he starts bragging about it and gloating and saying, I'm the greatest of all time. I can beat anybody. I'm better than Rocky Marciano ever was. I'm better than Joe Louis. I'm the greatest of all time. He's only 19 years old, but he's already bragging.
What'd they get, the Louisville Lip?
The Louisville Lip was his first nickname, and that was not meant to be polite or even amusing. It was because sports writers thought he was obnoxious.
Early on, to think about how he was despised even when he got to the top, he was despised locally. Like, there were a lot of sports writers when he started boxing that were like, all right, shut up.
Yeah, he's unsportsmanlike. Plus, he's black, and, you know, black people are not supposed to give any lip to white people at the time. So he's in big trouble for that. And that's even before he joins the Nation of Islam. And then it gets worse by a magnitude.
Really the turning point in his career, the 1960 Olympics. He has a tremendous fight when he's, what, 18, 19 years old. And then I think he's 20, he goes to the Olympics. He wins the gold medal at the Olympics. This is really where his career starts to take off, because it's just a matter of time before he's in the ring with Sonny Liston, and then his career, then he's the boxer we all know.
Yeah, and what happens at the Olympics is important, too, because he doesn't really look like a great fighter. And if you watch the early films of his fights, even in the Olympics and his first couple of pro fights, he doesn't look very good. And his technique is terrible. He's never really learned to box properly. And the only reason he's getting talked about as a potential opponent for the champ, Sonny Liston, is because he's such an amazing personality.
Yeah, keep talking.
He's the star of the Olympics because he's like the mayor of the village. Everybody just wants to be around him. He's such fun. And he gives such great quotes to the reporters that he's just like an instant story. You know, journalists would say all the time that anybody could write a great story about Cassius Clay or Muhammad Ali, because you just had to be around him and he'd fill your notebook or your tape recorder with gold. So he starts getting talked about as a challenger for Sonny Liston just because they know he can sell tickets. He's a born promoter.
And it's beyond just charm. He has a rhythm. He has a style in which he's taught, spoken word almost, the rhyme. I mean, yeah. Everything about him is, you never see that from an athlete, especially in the early 60s.
He's clever, he's funny as hell, and people can't get enough of it. So everybody assumes it's going to be over when he meets Liston, because Liston's going to kill this guy, but it's fun while it lasts. That's the attitude.
Up to that fight, what we knew of Cassius Clay was that he was a fast talker, and he was good, but he wasn't a great fighter. He was even undersized. And when you talk about a heavyweight fighter, he might fit the weight requirement, but he wasn't the right size to take on a Sonny Liston. So it wasn't until he got into the ring that anyone really had any respect for him.
Yeah, that's right. And people, well, because he was so fast and because he was built so beautifully, he didn't look like he was that big. But when you get in the ring against him, his opponents found out, wait a second, he actually hits pretty hard. That jab starts to wear you out after a while. And he was 6'3", you know, 210 at that point, pretty big, you know, so Sonny Liston looks like he's bigger and scarier. But once they get in there and Liston can't touch him because Ali's so fast, and then that jab starts to hit, and then Liston starts to slow down a little bit, and then the combinations start flying, suddenly Liston looks like a weak old man compared to this kid who's faster and big enough at that point.
Now, that's the last fight. The victory over Sonny Liston is really the last fight for Cassius Clay, because it's, what is it, the next morning that he wants to change his name, and then a month later he changed it to Muhammad Ali. But that was the moment in which this star was born, and so much so he even changed his name.
Absolutely. He comes out the next morning and says, I'm not a Christian anymore. That's a religion that was pushed on me when my people were slaves, and I don't have to be what you want me to be anymore. I'm the champion of the world. I don't have to do what you want me to do anymore. I'm free. And it's this massive declaration of independence, and it's met instantly with wild, wild hatred. Like, who the hell do you think you are? You know, followed by the N-word. And he becomes despised. If you thought he was unpopular before just for being a little sassy, now he's declaring alliance to the Nation of Islam, which most Americans consider to be like a terrorist group bent on the destruction of America.
Ringside is Malcolm X.
Yeah, Malcolm X is right there by his side. And Malcolm X and Elijah Muhammad, these are people the FBI is scared of. And most white Americans are just, you know, confused by, like, what's wrong with these people? So for Ali to join them, for the heavyweight champ who's supposed to be a symbol of American strength and honor, this is heresy.
It's amazing, the contrast. Because we just talked about at the Olympic Village, he's the mayor, he's Mr. Charm. Everyone wants to be around him. And then it takes him at the top, he gets to the top. You'd think that'd be the moment. And he uses that platform to declare independence, and he goes from the most charming and most liked to the most hated.
Yeah, and that was always a war within Ali. He wanted to be the most popular guy. He wanted to be loved. And he wanted to piss you off and rebel. So he's flushing Coca-Cola contracts down the toilet. Nobody's going to want an endorsement from this guy with this funny new name that nobody can spell or pronounce. And reporters refuse to use it. They keep calling him Cassius Clay. The New York Times, they keep calling him Cassius Clay. So he's willing to throw it all away because he believes he can he can take a stand, that he can challenge authority, and that's what really matters to him.
Jonathan Eig is my guest tonight. His new book, Ali, The Life, is the definitive biography of Muhammad Ali, one of the greatest athletes in history. We're talking about that. We want to talk more about the contrast, and all the contrast that's coming up here on The Download. We'll take a break for the news. We'll come back. Jonathan Eig, my guest at the big table. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight at the big table, the author of the new book, Ali, The Life, the definitive biography of Muhammad Ali. Jonathan Eig is an in-studio Chicago writer who's also written about Jackie Robinson, Lou Gehrig, the birth control pill, as well as many other things. We'll pick up where we left off with contrast. Muhammad Ali, at this point, he beats Sonny Liston. He declares his independence not just as a boxer, as an athlete, but as a man. He determines religion is one that was forced upon him. He doesn't have to do what the white man has to tell him. He changes the course of American athletics in a way, in the way that he brought politics in. He quickly became, he was loved, and now he's despised. What's next for him? Because it was a month later that he changes his name to Muhammad Ali. But he then, I guess the next step in his story is Vietnam.
Yeah, he begins to say, I don't want to go. First, he fails his IQ test, so he doesn't have to go. And then they need more soldiers, so they lower the cutoff rate, and they say, well, now you're eligible. And he says, wait a second, I'm not any smarter than I was last time. How come I was too stupid for the Army before, and now they want me?
And he's also the heavyweight champion of the world at that point.
Yeah,
and we see in history, I was talking to Pete about this earlier, but we see in history a lot of prominent figures being able to defer or find a way to get out of service. Muhammad Ali, they're saying, it's your time.
Yeah, that's right. And some people suggest that maybe it's he's being picked on. Maybe it's racist. Maybe they're trying to shut him up because they don't like his politics, because he's a member of this strange group, the Nation of Islam. And Ali at first isn't really helping his own cause. He says, well, I'm making a lot of money as a boxer, millions and millions of dollars, tax dollars that I'm raising. You can use that money to buy bomber jets and tanks and kill all the Vietnamese you want. I don't care. Just don't send me over there. Send some football players. They're bigger and stronger than I am. And then he says, well, wait a second. This whole war is racist. You know, black people are being drafted disproportionate numbers. If you're white.
Viet Cong never did anything.
Yeah,
right.
Viet Cong never called me the N-word. And if you're white, you can just call your daddy's lawyer and get a deferral. But why are they picking on black people? And I don't want to go over there and kill some dark-skinned people. And then he finally begins to say, well, this is against my religion. And that's the argument he ends up taking to the Supreme Court. He's convicted. He's sentenced to 5 years in jail. He loses his boxing license. He loses his heavyweight championship. Can't make a living. And has to, you know, appeal the case. He remains free. He doesn't go to jail. But while his case is being appealed, he remains free.
But he can't box at that point.
He loses the 3.5 years of his prime, probably the best years that he would have had as a boxer.
I feel like, Jonathan, that's a part of the story that for my generation and for generations past me don't know. Thinking about it as I'm reading this, I'm like, I can't believe that Muhammad Ali in the prime of his life, the one that we celebrate, was stripped of his boxing titles, was told he could never box again because of his position in the Vietnam War.
Yeah, if you think what Colin Kaepernick's going through now, imagine Ali. It was a million times worse, and he was the most hated man in America, at least in white America. He was despised. You know, not only did he lose his boxing license and his ability to make money in the ring, but he lost millions of dollars of endorsements. And it looked like he was going to go to jail. And he was offered a compromise. He was offered a deal where he would just box some exhibitions for the military. He said, hell no. This is my religious principles. It's all or nothing. I'm not going to violate my religious principles. I'd rather face a firing squad. He meant it.
And this is one of these areas of contrast where America and history remembers he was a conscientious objector because he had the famous line about the Viet Cong, and this was all about he was standing up for civil rights. But as you just pointed out, he had five different every time he was asked, he had a different answer on why he didn't want to go to war. So again, we remember a certain part of the legend of Muhammad Ali, but it might not necessarily be accurate.
That's right. And what matters is that he stood up for his convictions. That's what makes him courageous. But you have to also remember that he was not a civil rights warrior. He was opposed to the civil rights movement. He thought that integration was a terrible idea and that black people should live separately, and that until America allowed black people to live separately, there would never be peace. He was opposed to integration. He was opposed to intermarriage. He said he would never never want to see his children dating white people. Mm-hmm. He was, he's a very controversial, complicated guy.
Over time, getting to the 80s, 90s, 2000s, even when he was ill at the end of his life, did he look back and ever try to correct that narrative? Is there ever any interviews or other places where he says, everyone's got the wrong idea of what I was trying to do?
You know, it was really funny, and one of the things that drove me crazy for a while. In the late 70s, somebody said to him, do you have any regrets in life? Anything you would do differently? And he said, yeah, I wish I hadn't said that thing about the Viet Cong. I couldn't believe it. I was, what are you talking about? That's the most important thing you ever said. That's the reason that you are considered the most important athlete of the 20th century, because you took a stand against the war. What do you mean? And he said, well, I just wish that I hadn't made people so angry. And that's when it hit me that he, as much as he wanted to be admired, as much as he wanted to be seen as this icon, this important rebel, he also just really wanted to be loved. He couldn't stand the fact that people were mad at him.
It's a narrative in the book that from an early age, you paint a picture of a man who was searching out love, whether it was through love and his four marriages, the mistresses that were involved, and beyond that, the way that he would be charismatic to people on the street. If you walked by Muhammad Ali on the street, he would make sure to try and stop you to say, do you know who I am? There's a lot in there about him searching for love or wanting to be the center of attention or the center to be loved at all times.
Yeah, and maybe it comes from living with an abusive father. Maybe it's something else. You know, who knows? I'm not going to pretend to read his mind, but he absolutely just needed it. He hungered for it. If he was driving down the street and people didn't notice him, he would, you know, hang out the window. He would he once drove on the sidewalk of Michigan Avenue just because people weren't noticing him enough. And he figured, well, I better just drive on the sidewalk. That'll get people's attention.
It's kind of interesting when you think about today's world and you think about some of our leaders and celebrities and their relationship with fame. And the higher that you go, I think about the biggest, prominent, most, you know, influential people on Twitter. With that fame and that adulation or adoration comes this river of hate. Like you never can get to one place where there's 100% where people just love you. And it's interesting with Muhammad Ali, the higher he got, the bigger he became, the more hate was created.
Yeah, until the 70s, I think it starts to shift. You know, he's beaten by Joe Frazier. He has to fight his way back. He's seen as a martyr for the sacrifice he made in Vietnam. And he shuts up about politics and race to some extent. You know, he really just wants to be a celebrity at that point. And the 70s, you know, the society's changing. The Jeffersons are on TV and we have a different attitude about integration. And he starts to become much more beloved. And he likes it. He doesn't really want to go back to being the rebel anymore. And then late in his career, he starts getting slower. He's suffering the effects from all those punches. He starts losing his ability to speak clearly. And then by the time he retires, his hands are shaking. And he becomes like a lot more, I don't want to say pitiful, but we start to feel bad for him.
We see him as, we put him on a pedestal.
Yeah.
A lot because of his illness.
Yeah, we want him to be an angel. We want to put our arms around him and hug him, and we forgive all the stuff that ticked us off so much in the beginning. And because he doesn't really speak as much, it's easy to sort of imagine that he is all things to all people.
A lot of the contrast, and we haven't really even gotten into the, and we probably won't, but the Nation of Islam and his religious discipline versus the way he lived his life, which are complete contrasts. He had four different wives, one which the Nation of Islam wanted him to divorce. But then on top of it, the way that he womanized, even in front of his wives, you talk to some of his wives, or they've been interviewed at times, talked about just how he almost used sex in the same way that we're talking about, that he, this need to be loved. There's one great passage where one of his wives says he didn't even like sex. He just did it because it had so much more attached to it. And that's another part where he will always be remembered, especially in his rebellious time, as being this religious, pious man who stood for his convictions, even made a change in his religious philosophies. But there was a lot going on that America did not know about.
Yeah, it's very hard to make it all fit. You know, here's a guy who absolutely loved his first wife, but divorced her because the Nation of Islam told him to, because she wouldn't become a member of the religion. And then he remarries a young woman, 17 years old, who grew up in the Nation of Islam and is, you know, absolutely devout. But he begins cheating on her, you know, almost immediately, and expects her to go along with it, expects her to book rooms for the mistresses. And some of this comes from, again, having a father who was a playboy. Some of it comes from Elijah Muhammad, who, you know,
some of it comes from being the most successful.
And some of it just comes from
the famous person in the world.
Being famous and beautiful and the heavyweight champion of the world. And from the 1970s when, you know, society was pretty loose about sex. So all these forces come together and it makes for, you know, a crazy, crazy life that doesn't make sense if you just try to line it up with where his philosophy should lie.
Again, it doesn't gel with that legend.
No, but that's life, you know.
And that's life. Yes.
I think it's so important for people to read books about their heroes and not just look for them to be perfect. You know, accept the fact that these are human beings, and that's why they're interesting, and that's why, you know, they wouldn't be important if they were comic book characters or movie heroes.
The investigative part of your book, which is there's a lot in here that's investigative. You do a tremendous job with interviews and everything. The brain function part of this, where you're able to map where you start to see Muhammad Ali lose function earlier than we see it. The
right.
idea that at the beginning of his life as Cassius Clay, he's, like we talked about, spoken word, rhyme, he is a talker, the Louisville Lip, right?
Right.
But over time, as he continues in this career of boxing and taking punishment, that skill deteriorates.
Yeah, the point of boxing is really to concuss your opponent, to cause brain damage. And nobody really escapes that, especially if you fight 20 years like Ali did, or, you know, 30 years if you include his amateur boxing. So what I did was I worked with CompuBox to count the number of punches that Ali was hit with over the course of his career. We counted every punch,
wow,
round by round, fight by fight. And we can look at any punch, any fight, and pick out a round and see how many times he was hit, how many times he hit his opponent. And you start to see in the second half of his career, he's getting out hit dramatically. He's letting his opponents hit him until they get tired. And then he starts to fight back, which is a terrible, terrible formula for your brain's health. It might have won him a few fights, but it was not a smart. And he even began encouraging his sparring partners just to hit him in the head. He would keep his hands down because he believed he could build up resistance, that if he took enough shots to the head, kind of like building up calluses, he'd be, you know, immune to the knockout. And then I also worked with speech scientists to track his rate of speech. And he loses 26% of his speaking rate from age 30 to age 40 at a time when you shouldn't be losing any of your speaking rate. I'm speaking now just as fast as I did when I was 25, I hope, but I should be. He lost 26% of his speaking ability, and it started in 1970-71 when he was, you know, only 30 years old.
Wow. You had a chance to meet Muhammad Ali. He obviously didn't interview him for this book, but you had a slight encounter.
Yeah.
With him. Tell us about it.
Oh, man, I spent three and a half years trying to meet him and trying to ask him some questions, hoping that I could at least, you know, shake his hand and tell him I was doing this book. I went to his house and spent hours there, but he was not well and didn't come out of his room. I went to two or three different fundraisers where he was scheduled to appear, and he didn't make it. And finally, in the fall of 2015, I went to Louisville where he was getting an award, and I saw him sitting alone with his wife at the table. I was the only one in the room. I ran to the table, and I said hello to his wife, and she introduced me to Muhammad. And I was so nervous. I didn't know what I was going to say. I'd been, you know, dreaming of this moment for years. And finally, I just went up to him, and I held his hand, and I looked him in the eye, and I said, I'm writing your biography, and I know you didn't ask me to. I'm trying my hardest to do it right, and I'm so honored to have this privilege, and is there anything you want to say? You know, the last word is yours. And I stopped and I listened and I put my ear right by his side of his head, and he didn't say anything. And it was hard for me, you know. I was hoping for some kind of epiphany, some kind of a message, rosebud, right, you know. But it was okay, because I think, you know, the message that I took away from it was that it was his life, and it's my book, and it was my job to tell it, and I tried to do it as well as I could.
At the end of this book and this project, which has consumed half a decade,
yeah,
do you consider Muhammad Ali the greatest?
Yeah, without a doubt. He's great. He includes so much complication, so much contradiction, and greatness is an order of magnitude, and he contains multiple dimensions. He's so fascinating to me. You know, I don't always like him as much as I used to. There are things about him that I wish could have been different, but I think of him as being one of the greatest figures of the 20th century, and certainly the greatest that I've ever written about.
Jonathan Eig is the author of Ali, The Life, the Biography of Muhammad Ali. It's out now. It's new. Jonathan, of course, wrote about Jackie Robinson, Lou Gehrig, The Birth Control Pill, and other books as well, and writings. Jonathan, great to have you here. Great story, and thanks so much for being my guest at the big table.
Thank you.